Deborah, thank you very much. Deborah's been a friend for a long time. And Secretary Jewell, I got to see you backstage. There you are. It's a delight to be with you. I was telling Deb that Secretary Jewell is not only smart, she's tough. She gets things done. And it's a delight to work with her. And to all the tribal leaders here today, it's an honor. It's an honor to be back with you. You know, I'm here for one reason, the same reason the President has brought all of you together for the past 6 years. We understand, the President and I and Sally and our administration, we understand and respect that the words Indian Nation mean something. It's a simple proposition. As President Obama said, that tribal nations do better when they make their own decisions. And for well over a century, you have not been able to make your own decisions nearly enough. One of my earliest votes as a young senator, I was 34 years old, was to support the Indian Self-Determination and Education Assistance Act. I came to the Senate as a 29-year-old kid, and to be honest with you, the Nanticoke Indians in my state of Delaware had educated me a little bit. But quite frankly, it was at the knee of Danny Inouye I learned that how bad things continued to be when I got here. I learned about the abuses in state child welfare system that resulted in over a quarter of tribal children being sent off to live somewhere other than Indian country. So I was proud to support the Indian Child Welfare Act of 1978, a law that has had an enormous impact over the last 40 years. It's hard to believe it was ever different. It's hard to believe. As I said, my friend Danny Inouye opened my eyes to the challenges of Indian country, and it was an honor to work with him to help pass the Native American Graves and Repatriation Act, as well as legislation to establish the Museum of the American Indian. As chair of the Judiciary Committee, I look out and I see familiar faces. I don't see any woman as old as I am, but I see a couple guys close to my age that work with me. And by the way, in the Biden family, I don't know how this happened. There's no woman that's as old as any man. I don't know how the hell that happened, but it's just that's just the way it's worked from the time I've been born. But you think I'm kidding? I'm not. I work with many of you who are still around on as chairman of the Judiciary Committee on issues of tribal sovereignty. And I know that overall respect for you as nations is central to the very being of everyone sitting here in this audience today. But beyond that, I know the issues you focus on vary from nation to nation. One of the things that offends me is people say, well, Indian nations, everything's the same. It's different. It's different from the East Coast to the West, to the central part of the country, the Southwest. Not everyone has the same problems or the same concerns, any more than every state has the same problems or same concerns. There are multiple concerns on your agenda as you meet here this week. We recognize the difficulties you sometimes face working through state governments to secure, for example, federal disaster recovery funding. That's why the Sandy Recovery Improvement Act, fancy name, but after Hurricane Sandy, that's why we amended thing called the Stafford Act, so you could go directly to the President of the United States to request disaster declarations in times of need. We know the importance of preserving sacred lands and sites. That's why we took action to preserve places of great spiritual and cultural significance like Chimney Rock in Colorado and Oregon Mountain Desert Peaks in New Mexico. We also respect the right of sovereign governments to provide for their people. And that's why the President signed the Tribal General Welfare Exclusion Act, so your members no longer have to pay taxes for certain benefits you'd receive in Indian nations. And we want to do everything we can to promote economic development on tribal lands. Not all lands are equal in the sense of your economic circumstances. Some are in real need. All are in need, as we are in this country. That's why the President traveled to Indian country in June to talk about expanding access to capital, spurring investment, investing in education on tribal lands. And the President will be speaking to you later today about these issues as well as critical issues of importance like the situation for youth on reservations, something that he came back from his June visit fired up about doing something about. But today I want to talk to you about an issue I've engaged my interest and concern for the bulk of my career. Everyone asked me why I've been so passionate all these years about the Violence Against Women Act and that issue. Some think it was because maybe my mother or someone in my family was abused. Thank God no one was, but I was raised by a man, my father, a gentleman, who thought the most heinous crime anyone could commit was the abuse of power. And the ultimate abuse of power was a man raising his hand to a woman or to a child. My dad, unlike most people of his generation, not only thought that it was offensive, my dad taught us that we had an obligation when we observed abuse to intervene. I know I'll get in trouble for saying this with the press here, but it's not about vigilantism, it's about intervening. If you can stop it when you see it. To me, it's the definition of manhood. It's not about standing by and saying, well, that's a family affair. That's how I was raised. That's how many of you are. Some of you men and women in this ballroom know that the most horrific prison on earth is the four walls of an abused woman's home. And far too many Native American women, far too many, that's a daily reality, the four walls of their own home. Women on tribal lands face the highest rates of domestic violence and domestic abuse in all of America. More than half of Native American women experience physical violence by an intimate partner over their lifetime. Women like Lisa Brunner, who as a four-year-old on the Ojibwe reservation witnessed her mother beaten with a shotgun by her white husband, then grew up and faced the same abuse at the hands of her own white husband. The homicide rate against Native American women in some areas is more than 10 times the national average. One in three Native American women will be raped. It's an epidemic, not only in Indian nations, but in the country. An epidemic that cuts to the very core of how we measure ourselves as a society. When I began looking at this issue of violence against women decades ago, few people thought of it as a national epidemic. A lot of people had tried, a lot of good women and men had tried the two decades before to do something about it and raise it up, and it got nowhere. No one denied that kicking your wife in the stomach or smashing her face against a wall or pushing her down the stairs in public was repugnant. But our society basically turned a blind eye. Hardly anyone ever directly intervened, as the way my father taught us. Almost no one called it a crime. It was called a family affair, a cultural matter. When I began working the Violence Against Women Act in the late 70s, and really in earnest in the mid-80s, I was told that my efforts would cause the family to disintegrate. It would generate disintegration of the family of my trying to pass national laws relating to the right of a man to raise his hand to a woman. When we talked about giving those women a way out, a shelter, which we now have in the Violence Against Women Act, I was told by serious people, and it was written, that what I was doing was establishing indoctrination centers for radical feminization. There was no hotline like we have today, where over 3 million women have called for help. Few police officers, prosecutors, even judges, they were not trained to understand that this was not a family affair. I hate the term domestic violence. It makes it sound like a domesticated cat. It's the ugliest form of violence that can occur, in large part because of the fundamental violation of trust that is engaged. Everyone seemed content to keep this dirty little national secret hidden away in the closet, even our legal system. As a matter of fact, we learned there were scores of states, my own included, that had written into their laws the basic presumption that if a woman was raped or beaten or abused by her husband or someone she knew, she must have done something wrong. In my state of Delaware, you could not be convicted of first-degree rape if you raped someone on a date, as you could if it was stranger rape, you jumped out of an alley. The inherent presumption in the law that's been in our system for over 600 years, English jurisprudential system, was if you knew me and I did something horrible to you, you were partially responsible. You could be convicted of second-degree rape, but not first-degree rape. That was the background when I wrote the Violence Against Women Act in 1990. I was convinced then, as I remain convinced now, and I think we've proven it, that we had to rip the Band-Aid off, force Americans, decent Americans, in Indian nations and throughout the country, to look at the reality of what was happening. And so we called forward some brave survivors who testified with the whole nation listening, made people look at the ugliness of what was happening, because I was absolutely convinced the vast majority of us are decent and honorable. We would do something if we had to face it. I was convinced the basic decency of the American people would lead them to demand change. In 1994, we accomplished as much as we could. When we wrote the Violence Against Women Act, we knew there was much more we should be doing, but it was as much as the market would bear, and it made a difference. We made a great deal of progress in 20 years since the first passage of the Violence Against Women Act. Domestic violence rates dropped from 64% from 1993 to 2010. We saved millions of dollars. We saved millions of dollars in averted social costs, medical costs, loss in productivity. We have higher rates of convictions because of special victims units and fundamental reforms in state laws and police activity. We set up the first national domestic violence hotline. 3.4 million women and men have received help from that hotline. We knew that the first law left much unfinished business on the table. And the success of the law gave us the credibility that at every time we had to reauthorize it, we could add additional provisions we knew should have been involved in the first place. In 2000, for example, we added the definition of dating violence to protect women from violent boyfriends, as we did more than 30 states, as we did that more than 30 states followed. In 2005, we added new training programs for healthcare providers to screen their patients for domestic abuse because we know long-term psychological and physical health of the woman of an abuser, abused, continues to linger over periods of time. The CDC has shown now that there are long-term effects well after the beating stop. Chronic diseases result. It used to be, you know, 7 out of 10 women walk in an emergency room with a bruise, a broken bone, or there with the hand of a man. Doctors would know it, but they didn't want to do anything about it. They said, I ran into the door again. The medical profession is decent and honorable, but they didn't want to get involved either. Now that's all changed. We knew that the greatest piece of unfinished business remained. We knew back then, and we've known for 36 years since the Oliphant decision, that non-Native American men were free to abuse their wives and girlfriends on tribal lands with impunity, immune from prosecution by tribal courts. The people like Deb and all the leaders in this room were relentless. You kept up the fight. And last year, you all spoke as one, women and men, all nations. You spoke of as one, standing shoulder to shoulder with leaders in Congress like Patty Murray. We owe her a debt of gratitude. And Congressman Tom Cole of Oklahoma, who said, it's all or nothing. All or nothing. Because they understand as long as there is a single place where the abuse of power is excused as a question of jurisdiction or tolerated as a family affair, no one is truly safe. And we cannot define ourselves as a society that is civilized. Tribal governments have an inherent right. As a matter of fact, they have an obligation to protect their people. And all people deserve to live free of fear. All people. And thanks to your effort, and I mean this sincerely from the bottom of my heart, thanks to your efforts, we took a big step forward toward protecting those rights when the President signed the Violence Against Women Act reauthorization of law last year. But there's more to do. And starting on March the 7th of next year, tribal governments will have the power to investigate, prosecute, convict, and sentence non-Native Americans who assault their wives and girlfriends on tribal land. Though it's not within my power, I apologize for taking so long, so many women damaged in the meantime. It also makes it crystal clear that tribal governments have the right to issue and enforce real protection orders, order of protection, stay away orders. So when a tribal police get a call from a woman who's isolated in a stretch of reservation, her voice trembling with fear, and you've heard it say, I see his truck, I can hear it. I know he's coming. I know he's coming. Please, please, please help me. Come with me to the hotline, and you'll hear minute after minute calls like that coming in, not just from tribal lands, from all over America. Now, in tribal lands, they can actually do something about it. Several tribes already are part of a pilot program and are putting these authorities into practice. In fact, one tribe even reported that an abuser confidently told the arresting officer that he couldn't touch him under the law until the officer was able to inform him, the law is changed, Jack. You got a problem. You have got a big problem. And we're determined to do everything in our power to help every tribal government secure the resources they need to put this law into effect. That's why I'm calling on Congress to make good on the $25 million pledge in tribal grants authorized under the law so we can make this work. And Attorney General Holder, a true champion of tribal sovereignty, who you'll hear from later, is going to continue working with your law enforcement officers to make sure that the needs of the abused are being met and officers have the resources to enforce the law. But as each of the tribal leaders here have known and supported from the beginning, there's a need for due process. It is endemic to who we are as a culture, endemic to Indian culture, that this process be fair. And there are still some tribes that are going to have to implement these due process requirements before the law can take effect in Indian nations. That's why the Justice Department is available to help in that process. But once this authority is restored, tribes have a responsibility to use it, have a responsibility to use it, to enforce it, enforce the law, prosecute, stand for the women who have for too long endured not just injustice, but indifference. My mother used to say the worst of all sins is indifference. We need to continue to change the culture all across America, whether it's in Indian country or in a state capital. I believe, as I said, that the measure of any society, how civilized it is, the extent to which it tolerates what my father considered the cardinal sin of all sins. We're still tolerating much too much. Much too much. We're still falling short of the standard we espouse. As Lisa Brunner put it, our tribal officers have jurisdiction for the first time to do something about certain crimes. But it is just the first sliver of the full moon that we need to protect us. We need to expand that moon. You need to expand the moon by giving the nations of Alaska the same authority to protect their people that we're extending to all other nations. You need to expand the moon by giving nations everywhere the right to prosecute and convict strangers who hurt or rape victims on tribal lands. We need to expand the moon, changing the culture that tolerates the abuse of a woman by a man, native or non-native. We need to expand the moon, fundamentally changing the way domestic violence is talked about in Indian country. We need people to speak up and speak out, because violence against women is not a woman's issue alone. It's a man's issue. It's on us to do something about it. It's on all of us to change the culture. A culture that asks the wrong questions. It's never the right question for a woman to ask, "What did I do?" It's never, never appropriate. The question should be, why was it done to me? And will someone do something about it? Folks, we need to expand the moon. And while we'll never completely eliminate domestic violence, we have succeeded. And we'll succeed. When there's not a single woman, a Native American woman, whose first instinct after being abused is to ask, "What did I do?" That's what we found out in 1,000 hours of hearings I held. The culture was, what did I do? Is my skirt too short? Did I not have the dinner on the table on time? Did I use the wrong inflection in my voice? Never, never, I say to all you women and tell your daughters, never, never is that a justification for a man to raise his hand. And never should it be asked by a woman, "What did I do?" And we'll have succeeded. And there's not a single man among us in America who thinks he has a right to raise his hand to a woman anywhere for any reason other than self-defense. Never. We'll still have violence, but that's when the culture will have changed. When no man thinks in the back of his mind he has a right to raise his hand. And when no woman, no matter what her mistake was, says, "Well, maybe if I hadn't done that, I wouldn't have had this done to me." And when we finally get there, it'll be because of people like you, people in this room, people who fought for this law, and continue to fight for the authority to ensure justice and fairness for everyone in your nations. It's an honor to be by your side as we fight for that full moon. There's an old Chinese proverb that my sister uses all the time and a couple editorial writers use, and it's worth remembering. It says, "Women hold up half the sky." Women hold up half the sky. and they're entitled to every single solitary opportunity, every single solitary right, every single solitary protection of law that men are. I know we'll get there because I know how far we've come in such a short time. And I promise you, as long as I'm around, as long as the president's around, even after we're no longer holding office, we will continue to fight to make sure that our daughters and our granddaughters and our great-granddaughters are freer and freer and freer, and our sons understand their obligations and what the real definition of manhood is. God bless you all. May God bless Native American and Indian nations, and may God protect our troops. Thank you very much.